Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million. There's an interesting observation to be made here about the global economy. Things usually happen really, really slowly until they happen really, really fast. I'll explain. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Thursday today, the 16th of May. Good as always to have you along, everybody. We begin today with this. 10 days ago, a mere week and a half, every indication was that the trade disagreements between the United States and China were all but solved. A couple of more meetings, a quick Trump-Xi phone call, done and done. Now, it's tariffs as far as the eye can see, and as of yesterday, quite possibly a breakdown in the heavily integrated and extremely globalized technology supply chain. We refer here, of course, to the Trump administration effectively blacklisting the Chinese technology giant Huawei, which will cut that company off from its American suppliers, chips from Qualcomm and phone software from Google, to name just a couple. You roll that in with bans on Huawei in other countries, and as Marketplace's Scott Tong reports now from Washington, there does seem to be something of a digital iron curtain descending.
If the U.S. shoots at Huawei, it also hits its own foot. Inside Huawei gadgets are innards from firms like Intel, Oracle, and Western Digital. But tech firms sensing the crossfire are trying to get out of the way and avoid partnering with companies subject to bans and retaliation, says Lindley Gwenap of the Lindley Group.
I think that companies are trying to reduce their exposure to the bans and buy fewer components from countries that could be affected.
The word decoupling is being whispered in the U.S. and China. That is, each country may develop its own separate supply chain. Huawei has long been on Washington's hit list and is trying to make parts like semiconductors in-house. Business professor Tan Huang at Zhejiang University has a new book on Huawei. He says the company can be self-sufficient.
They can make it itself. Maybe it's not as good as the U.S. components, but it's not much worse. They still can sell their products. So they're prepared for this more than 10 years.
Huawei's DIY project could accelerate Chinese innovation. And in areas like wireless 5G, many see Huawei as already ahead. So the U.S. might not want to cut itself off, says political scientist Abraham Newman at Georgetown.
France in the 1980s, it tried to develop its own internet, and it was kind of ridiculous. And the risk is that we end up with a new version of that, a lesser-than 5G network.
He says the U.S. is weaponizing interdependence and could unravel a global tech supply chain that took a generation to come together. I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
You can argue till the cows come home about tariffs. Who wins, who loses, who pays. Wait, no, you can't. Consumers pay and nobody wins. But there is at least one agreed-upon reality when it comes to what tariffs do to an economy. The way things normally work don't work anymore. Marketplace's Sabri Benishore explains that one.
I don't know if you've ever grown plants in a terrarium. They love it in there because they're protected. But when you take them out and expose them to the outside world, they don't always do well. They're not strong.
It breeds a kind of laziness here.
Simon Lester is with the Cato Institute, and he's not talking about terrariums. He's talking about tariffs. Tariffs that protect some U.S. businesses from foreign competition.
You don't have to compete with the best in the world. You can just sort of relax. You don't have to work that hard. You're not going to face any competition.
U.S. steel companies, for example, don't face as much pressure to upgrade plants now. They can and are raising prices without competition from foreign steel producers.
Ultimately, I think if you want successful businesses, you want them competing in order to, you know, be as efficient as possible.
Chinese goods don't usually compete with U.S. goods head-on. We don't make a lot of the same stuff, but many goods that are made in America are made with Chinese parts. Tariffs make those parts more expensive. Tim Keough teaches economics at the University of Minnesota.
It's going to make things that the U.S. sells to the rest of the world be more expensive, and we're going to lose market share because of that.
But the disadvantages go beyond that. Take the tariffs on steel and aluminum. The metal that would be going into the U.S. now goes to global markets, increasing supply and depressing prices outside the U.S. Rufus Yerxa is president of the National Foreign Trade Council.
Many of my manufacturers say that this has a direct impact on their competitiveness, not only because their costs go up, but actually their foreign competitors' costs go down.
Yerxa says the more an industry is protected, the less productive it's likely to become. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishour for Marketplace.
In higher education news on this Thursday, three much-reviled letters, S, A, and T. The College Board, purveyor of the aforementioned exam, is adding a new score to it, math, reading and writing, the optional essay, and now adversity, as in the hurdles like neighborhood crime and poverty that students might have dealt with getting into college. It's yet another attempt by the College Board to keep its core product, the SAT, relevant as the idea of who gets in where gets more attention. Marketplace's Amy Scott has more on that.
When Scott Verzile was weighing student applications this college admission season, he had another tool to consider. He's dean of undergraduate admissions at the University of South Carolina. Along with grades and essays and test scores, an environmental context dashboard offered details like family and housing stability, access to AP classes, and neighborhood poverty and crime.
And that did help us find some students that we probably would have otherwise not considered.
The university was one of 50 testing out the dashboard this year. The College Board will roll it out to all schools next year, and it'll be free. But SAT critic Robert Schaefer with Fair Test says it's a business move. With selective colleges under pressure to admit more students of color and low-income students, more of them are making standardized tests optional.
People have long known that test scores were an excellent measure of accumulated advantage. And now the College Board is going to admit it by saying you can't use raw scores. You have to examine them in context.
The College Board has tried something like this in the past. In the late 1990s, its so-called Strivers program aimed to take socioeconomic factors, including race, into account. But Schaefer says critics accused the College Board of backdoor affirmative action, and the program was dropped. Tiffany Jones directs higher ed policy at the Education Trust, an advocacy group. She says the dashboard doesn't include race.
Without looking at race explicitly, it's very difficult to try to account for racial inequality.
Students also won't know their scores, adding another layer of mystery to the college admissions process. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
There was a fairly brief but all-important announcement from Boeing today, a quick four paragraphs, the first sentence of which read, Boeing has completed development of the updated software for the 737 MAX, which is big. The company says it's working with the FAA to get the planes back in the air. Investors were reassured. Boeing shares up 2.3%. Today, the broader market's up as well. Not as much, though. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Hollywood is trying, not always succeeding, but trying to get more diversity into its products, both on screen and off. Back in 1996, Christy Hallbeger started doing that in the magazine world. There weren't any American magazines for Latina audiences 22-something years ago, so she started one, Latina Magazine, beauty, fashion, and entertainment for bilingual, bicultural Latinas, published in English. Since then, Hallbeger's moved into movies and the talent business. She is now the head of multicultural business development at CAA, where it is her job, and she will tell you her mission, to diversify Hollywood on and off the screen. Christy Hallbeger, welcome to the program.
Thanks. I'm happy to be here.
So you have been in, I guess you could say, the business of getting this society, but also Hollywood, more multicultural for a long time now, right? 15 years at CAA and 20 years or so since you founded Latina Magazine. How are we doing?
Well, you know, it's interesting. I think that if you told me in, you know, 1996 when we launched Latina, that 20 years from now you're going to be having the same conversation, I would have said, oh, there's no way people are going to totally get it by then. Like when the 1990 census came out, there was a Time magazine cover that said, oh, this is going to be the decade of the Hispanic, which I think apparently got rescheduled maybe twice. And so I've sort of been through this a few times, but I'm inspired and I see progress and we can't fall off the floor, so we're not going backwards.
Are we having a better conversation, though? I mean, 20 years ago, you put J-Lo on the cover of the first Latina magazine. Now she's, you know, a multi-mega star, and she's doing great, but is the overall conversation better?
Well, I think the overall conversation is better. I think it's complicated because, you know, we've got a political moment that, you know, often demonizes our population and has made it a political opportunity out of doing so. And I think that that erodes the credibility of the, this is a valuable audience and this is a valuable marketplace. And all of those things tear at the fabric of not only who we are, but how we think of one another. And so I think it's a back and forth still.
You go to law school, you found Latina magazine, and then you wind up somehow in Hollywood. How did that happen?
Well, I think there's your work and then there's your life's work. And I think that my life, you know, I went into the magazine business not because I wanted to be in the magazine business, but because I wanted to tell stories and to see our faces and think that our lives are as valid as anyone else's who was on a magazine cover. And we'd never been on magazine covers. And so I was motivated by a sense of I wanted to, you know, correct that and be included. And I think that my move into entertainment, you know, producing a movie like Spanglish was similarly motivated. It wasn't because I just wanted to be in the movie business or I'm at CAA because I want to be in the entertainment business. It's because I actually see an opportunity that aligns with my personal sense of mission.
When you got to CAA in 2005, based on a little research I did about your time there, they apparently came to you and said, you have to execute on a multicultural strategy. And they said, you'll figure out what that is. Have you figured it out yet?
I've almost got it. I'm almost there. No, I think, you know, listen, when we were first starting out, I think the idea was like, oh, we need to change the composition of the roster. And one of the most important things about doing this is actually changing the composition of who is in the industry, who's making the decisions, who's choosing to represent folks. And I think, you know, we needed to think about the entire ecosystem of the industry and changing the complexion of that. And we've been making real strides. I mean, we're not there by any means, but boy, it's a lot better than it was.
Okay, so look, there is the moral imperative of what you're doing, right? Just basic justice in this economy. Hollywood is, if nothing else, a very bottom line business. So when you go and you have these conversations with the white guys running the meetings, at which probably you are the only Latina or female or person of color, frankly, are you heard?
Yeah, I think that yes, absolutely. And I think, you know, when there are things like, you know, Black Panther or Crazy Rich Asians, the thing that I share with people all the time, and I am the only one in the room, and I'm lonely, you know, because I'd like there to be a lot more of us on the room. But being able to show people that when you have a show, you know, a movie like Crazy Rich Asians, yes, overwhelmingly the Asian American audience showed up, but they're only 6% of the population. They were 36% of the ticket buyers. The thing that I share with people over and over is that 64% of the people who went to see that movie are not Asian American. They are people who love a rom-com. And so, you know, when you have 495 shows on television and you have every media consumption option in the world available to you, you have to show things that we haven't seen before if you're going to attract an audience. And so, yes, I am motivated by a personal sense of mission about changing who has access to tell stories. But the reason that it's sustainable and scalable is that it's actually a great opportunity for our business and a great business success.
Kristy Hauberger, she's at CAA. She also founded Latina Magazine. Thanks a lot for your time. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me. I'm honored to be here.
In a whole lot of places in this country, housing is expensive, really prohibitively expensive. Except you gotta live somewhere. Right? And that can mean thinking outside the traditional house. So here with today's installment of our regular series, My Economy.
My name is Daryl Madden. I'm a communications consultant. I am a long-term resident of Southwest D.C., and I've been a long-term liveaboard boater for 13 winters. I remember my first boat, I think I paid probably $70,000 for it. But the interesting thing about it is, you know, it's very much like a mortgage. You can write off the interest. So there's all that kind of economic advantages that happens to it. I don't know if owning a boat can be considered affordable housing, but relatively speaking, compared to some of the other condos that are now here dotting their way around Southwest DC, it certainly is an option. Maintenance is the biggest thing involving a boat. So, you know, you have to stay vigilant with it. So this is back in 2013. As most people do, you go through a spring commissioning. The mechanic that was assigned to do the work had made a judgment and error, and a fire ensued. Basically burned the boat to the waterline. It's very humbling when you kind of leave and you go to work, and then you come back and you realize that everything that you have is basically gone. Literally, as the boat was continuing to burn, many of the people in this marina gathered things that I needed for the next 24 hours to help me to get through. It is just the way that they surrounded me and supported me during that time was just something that I'll absolutely never forget. I ask anyone, tell me of a community, particularly in a major urban environment like Washington, D.C., that not only do you know all the neighbors on your street, but you know every neighbor three and four streets down. That is at the heart of what it's like to live in a marina community.
Daryl Madden there from the Gangplank Marina in Southwest Washington, D.C. for our series, My Economy. This series does only happen with your help, you know, so if you would take a second and share your story with us, we'd be grateful. You can do that at marketplace.org. Coming up.
It's absurd because I have like every credit card I've ever had and like all of my accounts and all of my loans.
When your financial lives collide, but first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial is up 214 today, 0.8%, closed at 25,862. Did the blue chips. The NASDAQ advanced 75 points, about 0.9%, 78.98. The S&P 500 climbed 25 points, 0.8%, 28.76 there. Bank stocks rose after some positive economic data. Housing starts were up more than forecasted. Jobless claims fell more than people thought they would. Et voila, Citigroup up 1.7%, JPMorgan Chase found 1.2% today, Walmart up 1.4%, the mega retailer beat expectations. On the other end of the retail spectrum, though, luxury online retailer Farfetch plunged more than 10% after reporting disappointing quarterly results. Bond prices fell, the yield on the 10-year Treasury note rose to 2.39%. Boy, that'd be something, wouldn't it? You're listening to Marketplace.
Hi, I'm Molly Wood, host of Marketplace Tech. On our show, we go beyond the latest gadget announcements to talk about the ideas behind the newest technology and how tech is changing our lives, our jobs, and our economy. It'll make you think differently about the tech you use at home and at work. Join me each weekday for Marketplace Tech. Find it wherever you like to podcast.
This Marketplace podcast is supported by Palo Alto Networks. As you innovate to transform your business in today's digital world, how do you stay secure? At Palo Alto Networks, our mission is to protect your digital way of life. Whether it's unprecedented opportunities or uncertainties with AI and whatever comes next, we continually deliver innovation to make each day safer and more secure than the one before. More at paloaltonetworks.com.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Brides magazine has at last found a match. Brides has been showcasing glamorous dresses and elaborate floral centerpieces for 85 years now, but print readership has been, well, unfaithful, maybe. So Condé Nast put it up for sale last year. The online brand Dot Dash is the buyer, amount not disclosed. Dot Dash is in turn owned by Barry Diller's media conglomerate IAC, which also happens to own dating apps like Tinder and Match and OkCupid. So, anybody thinking about a corner on the digital romance market here? Marketplace's Megan McCarty-Carino has that one.
LA dating coach Julie Spira loves getting to that big moment with her clients when they finally find a match, go exclusive, and say goodbye to online dating apps.
We have what we call a commitment ceremony, where the couple takes down their dating profiles.
Great for romance seekers, less great for dating apps.
All the dating apps lose their customers when they're happy and they find a match.
But what if these companies could hang on to users after they pair off? That's the potential of this bride's deal, says Eric Gordon, a business professor at the University of Michigan.
If you have a brand that works with customers, you want to extend the brand across all the platforms the customers might use.
That could mean targeting brides' digital content to users migrating away from Tinder and Match, and offering more strategic advertising opportunities with all the data those apps collect.
Data is like gold, maybe even better than gold. You can try to sell them a lot more stuff at the time you think they want that stuff.
For Barry Diller and Dotdash, repositioning the legacy magazine as a digital brand is key to reaching younger generations, says Americus Reed, a marketing professor at the University of Pennsylvania.
Younger consumers are now fully integrated into their devices. This is how they find mates. They're getting their information and news off of social media.
And despite Bride's flagging print readership, demand for the content is higher than ever, says Rebecca Sterner, an independent magazine analyst.
It's a well-respected brand. The name is great. The traffic is great. It's perfect for online content.
So from dating to wedding to planning honeymoons and investments, Diller's empire could keep users engaged till death do us part. I'm Megan McCarty-Carino for Marketplace.
Let me run this by you, see what you think. You take all your financial data, credit cards, bank accounts, the whole smash, and you enter them into an app. You can track your spending, yes, keep to your budget, maybe set some savings goals. But privacy, anyone? Data security, any worries about that? Yeah, I thought so. That's why the financial services company Fidelity, which you should know is an underwriter of this program, has launched a new business aimed at letting customers control what data those apps can get their hands on. Marketplace's Justin Ho has that one.
I'm sitting with Hillary Powers at her apartment in Queens, and we're going through her account on the website Mint. That's a personal finance tool she uses to pull together her financial accounts, all 34 of them.
It's absurd, because I have like every credit card I've ever had and like all of my accounts and all of my loans.
Right now, she's showing me how she runs through her credit card transactions to see if Mint labeled them correctly, with categories like groceries or restaurants. The labels aren't always right.
I went to like the gutter, which is bowling. They called it alcohol. I'm going to switch that to entertainment, just because I do have an entertainment budget.
Apps like Mint are often called aggregators, since they aggregate people's financial data into one place. Nate Pacer, the founder of the research outfit Venture Scanner, says there are nearly 300 of them.
You can do things like personal budgeting, tax preparation, credit card rewards points.
To get the aggregator to work, users typically enter their login info and answers to their security questions. The aggregator then stores that information and can access the user's account. Stuart Rubenstein at Fidelity says consumers aren't always aware of how their data is actually used.
Some companies aggregate consumer data and sell it. Some companies use it to build new products. Some companies use it for research.
Rubenstein's heading up a new business called Akoya, which is owned by Fidelity's parent company. It'll act as an intermediary. Instead of handing over login info to an aggregator app, customers would use Akoya to connect the apps to their bank accounts. And it would help them decide what data their apps can access.
If you're using a budgeting app, you need to look at your spending. When you're doing financial planning, you might need to look at a whole financial picture.
The service is geared toward giving customers more control of their data. But the target market is really the banks themselves, says Myra Rodriguez-Valladares at MRV Associates.
I really think this is much more bank-driven, since they're keenly aware of the actual costs and capital costs to these kinds of problems.
Valladares advises banks on regulatory issues. She says banks already have to worry about cyber attacks. And if an aggregator is breached and customer login info or data gets out,
any of those problems will come back to haunt the bank, and it becomes the bank's problem from the perspective of the bank regulator.
Akoya would charge banks for the service rather than customers or the aggregator apps. The idea is that a service like Akoya could protect a bank if an aggregator app is breached in a cyber attack, says Aviva Leighton, who follows cybersecurity for the research firm Gartner.
It seems that this new Fidelity business is a good way for banks to not let the aggregator get more information than they need.
Akoya is hoping that banks will sign up for its service instead of striking their own deals with aggregator apps. A few years back, JP Morgan Chase reached a deal with Mint that limited its access to Chase accounts. Akoya is also hoping that people like Hillary Powers will keep valuing the convenience of aggregator apps over any privacy risks.
It makes me feel like I'm like paying attention and being like responsible, at least financially, by focusing on where my money's going and when.
Akoya is set to launch later this year. In New York, I'm Justin Ho for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, in which you got to give them credit, but look, it's just not going to happen. There's a petition circulating on change.org with this tagline: remake Game of Thrones Season 8 with competent writers. As of this writing, let's see, 596,434, no, 435 people have signed this thing. Now, I hear you. Season 8 has some holes, but HBO spent a gazillion dollars on Season 8. Production has wrapped. Everybody has gone on with their lives. Let's do the same. Also, I think Sansa winds up on the Iron Throne. I don't know. All right, we got to go. Dow Industrial is up 214 today, 0.8%. The NASDAQ up 75 points, about 0.9% there. The S&P 500 climbed 25 points, 0.8%. Amir Bibawi, John Buckley, Eve Epstein, John Gordon, Heron Bikella, and Betsy Streisand are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is Deirdre Depke. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.